to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve sits for an interview with BBC journalist Kirsty Lang, who invites him to share his thoughts about the current threat landscape, nation-state cybercrime, and the role of government and big tech in enhancing security for all.
Hi, Steve. Well, it's great to be talking to you today. Let's start with one of the big topics of the moment, ransomware. Mm-hmm. Long been used as a tool of criminal organizations, but it's no longer limited to those bad actors, is it? In fact, it's becoming a little bit of a strategy instrument. I mean, do you think it's fair to say that ransomware is out of control?
Is it out of control? I think that what I would say about it, Kirsty, is that it's becoming the threat of the day, if I could put it that way. So on a number of different levels. So when I talk to businesses, doesn't actually matter where they are in the world or which sector they happen to be in, the first thing that people will ask me about is ransomware. You know, should we be worried about it? How can we combat it? And that kind of thing. What we have seen is a maturing of that product offering. So now we're into not just ransomware, but ransomware as a service. So you needed a little while ago to have a degree of competence before you dropped a ransomware package into an organization. You don't necessarily need that anymore.
You just buy it off the shelf.
You just buy it off the shelf. And you can have, you know, 24-hour support and guaranteed effectiveness or your money back and that kind of thing. So it's evolved. It's commoditized. Mm. And I think that's really the more worrying trend for businesses. Of course, then you're going to move into things like the impact of that on critical infrastructure. And then you start to get into, well, now who is using that? So we move on from the perhaps opportunistic hacker, much more towards perhaps nation state. And that again is a concern because, frankly, if somebody of that degree of competence has his or her eye on you, you're probably in trouble. And so it means you have to really put in place the means to get back up and running. And that focuses everybody then on what I would call the basics, which is how do we protect what's most important to us, where, and so on. So if I want to take a sort of optimistic view on ransomware, I would say that what it's actually doing is bringing about much stronger cyber hygiene across an organization, because it's the only way that you're going to be able to recover and survive.
Now, according to a recent Microsoft report, attacks targeting, you mentioned critical national infrastructure, have doubled in the past year from 20% of all nation state attacks to 40%. How much of this can be attributed to the war in Ukraine, and how much can be attributed to the, you know, what you just mentioned, the fact that this malware is much easier to deploy?
Well, for some while, we've been concerned about, some might call them rogue states, nation states, and their ability to influence. So you'll remember not that many years ago, people getting very upset about interference in the US elections, for instance. There was big concern about what that might mean for the midterms. So again, none of this stuff is new. What is new is the prevalence of it, the frequency of it, and the fact that it's very much easier to do now than it ever was. So when we talk about cybercrime, I mean, I don't need to go back that long. And I remember at one of our congresses, I think it was Las Vegas, talking to Misha about cybercrime gangs and the way that that was developing.
It's Misha Glennie, the author of McMafia.
Absolutely. And we were talking then about a degree of immaturity when we compare it with where we are today. So the world is moving very, very quickly in that cybercrime space. So we shouldn't be surprised that nation states, governments are able to make use of those tools. And cybercrime has become big business. You know, I've always described it as a very, very successful entrepreneurial business.
It is now sort of almost being industrialized.
It's
a scale issue now.
It is. And they're run very, very efficiently, very, very effectively. They are large corporations, very efficient large corporations with research and development functions.
I mean, just going back to the nation state actors, is it the case that most of the nation state backed cyber attacks are still conducted for the purpose of intelligence gathering, basically, and data theft, rather than it being explicitly destructive?
Yes, it is. There is a great deal of value placed on extracting information, watching what's going on. And this is something of a concern because most organizations really don't know for, I don't know, 90 days, 120 days, that anybody is living on their network. And you think about the amount of information you exfiltrate in that sort of period of time, you can get some very, very juicy insights into what's going on. And that information is valuable. It's no different from the way that spycraft was many, many years ago. I remember listening to head of MI5 talking about that and saying when he had started out, you know, he'd had to sort of lurk around wet and windy alleys trying to pick up information. Now, of course, it was so much easier because you just sat in a nice warm room and went online and off you went. So we've always had people trying to capture critical information, not necessarily for what they might do with it today, but for the value that it might have tomorrow and for that perspective that it gives you on the stage of development of other nations that perhaps you want to keep an eye on.
How concerned should we be by the growing collaboration between nation states and criminal groups? Because those lines are increasingly becoming blurred, aren't they?
They are. And there is a concern that some nations are funding cyber criminals in order to create that air gap so that they can deny an attack come the day if they need to. And I think that's, again, probably just a natural evolution. And you know, I don't want to sort of sound blasé about it, but I really do think it is. I think that, you know, if anybody has information that's of value, somebody today is going to want to look at it, monitor it. And an easy way of doing that is via criminal gangs. So we're starting to see the rise of cyber mercenaries, you know, criminals for hire who have very high skill sets, who will do pretty much what you want them to do. And you do have plausible deniability then if you're a nation state.
And I guess you could say historically as that's always happened, hasn't it?
Exactly.
You sort of remember after the Second World War, the US military cooperating with the mafia because it was useful. So we shouldn't be surprised. But if governments and nation states are using hackers for their own agendas, can governments be trusted to introduce legislation intended to protect organizations from hacking?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question. And it comes back for me to what is the role of government? And there's a lot of debate. I mean, my view on this has always been that from a business standpoint anyway, what I'm looking for government to do is to set parameters, very clear parameters within which, as a businessman, I'm able to operate. So make it clear to me what is in and what is out of scope. Then you get into a different question completely, which is around trust. So do we trust our politicians to make the right calls? Do they have the right level of understanding, which is the first challenge?
Do you think they do?
I think that they've got a little better. I don't think that they are absolutely there. I mean, I think if you look at the UK, you see some of the things that are going on here. You know, there are various advisory boards. NCSC does a very good job of trying to keep government on the straight and narrow when it comes to what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. But we're never going to get away from the fact that politicians are not cyber professionals. Very few politicians, particularly in the UK today, have actually come from business. They're professional politicians. So they're not necessarily going to have the skill sets that are required. So they're going to have to fall back on the civil service or on expert groups. So the question is whether or not they're going to take the time to do that, whether we're going to fund it effectively. And if we don't, then we won't have regulation that we can trust and we won't have that clarity. And that will impact, obviously, on the business side of things.
So I suppose the onus then is really on this sector to be lobbying, to be trying to inform our political leaders, because it's difficult for political leaders to keep the pace up, isn't it? I mean, given the pace of technological change, to keep up with those developments.
No, it is. And I think this is where the role of that sort of public-private partnership comes in. You know, if you look at the way some standards bodies have operated, if you look at NIST, for instance, NIST in the United States, very good example of a public body that very actively solicited detailed input from private and public sector to come up with a framework that, okay, is not perfect, but actually has the input from the people who know what they're talking about. If you look at the ISF, you know, we are a community-based organization. So when we produce things like our standard of good practice, that is effectively crowdsourced. We work very closely with ISO, work very closely with NIST, and various other bodies as well. So what we're trying to do, in much the same way as NIST does, is to get this broader perspective that we can really bring together to provide the best of the best that, from our perspective, our members can then take on and use to put in place the most appropriate frameworks, policies, procedures that suit their business. So again, I think there is a danger in this of government becoming almost too prescriptive. And there are parts of the world where we've seen that take place, where the regulator almost becomes like another police force. I don't think that's healthy. I think that it is much more about collaboration. And I think to do that effectively from a government standpoint, you have to rely on the private sector.
Now, what can you tell us about the prevalence of financial crime phenomena such as phishing email, deepfakes? Phishing, of course, has long been a big business and a big threat. What's the business opportunity for cyber criminals in the age of deepfakes?
I think deepfakes is a concern in as much as the user, as the end user, the onus is beginning to fall more on you. So you can no longer, and this is probably a sad reflection on the way that technology has developed, actually, you can no longer trust what you see on the screen.
I know, it's extraordinary what they do now.
It is. Yeah. And you know, I think we've still got a little bit of that. When I go onto the internet, this perception that actually that's a safe environment, and it's not. It's the Wild West. And so I think that what it does mean is that the user has to be more skeptical, has to really, I suppose, look for flaws. We're going to see, I hope, a move towards more trusted environments. But you know, that's going to be short-lived as well, because sooner or later somebody will hack into it and remove the trust there. So I think that it's an education process, which is why certainly from my perspective, I've been talking for many years about the need to bring cyber education, not just into secondary schools, but in primary schools. Mm-hmm. If you think about the way that children are adopting technology, some would argue that even primary school is too late. It should be in nurseries and so on. So as soon as somebody's touching a screen, you begin to educate them into what good looks like and how to use it and how to really be quite savvy in terms of looking at the information that's there. But you also have to provide people with a route that they can go down when they're uncertain. Mm. And this is really important in the business environment, particularly as we've moved to have people working remotely. Very often, to your point about phishing, phishing attacks are successful because people do not know who to contact when they think something is a little bit untoward. And a lot of businesses could make lives a lot easier for themselves by simply clarifying that. So if you look at something, you think you're not quite sure, what do you do? Who do you tell? You know, don't click on it and see, but ask somebody. And so that's a very simple, very basic procedure or process.
And if you were in an office, you'd ask. You'd probably turn to your colleague, wouldn't you, and go,
exactly.
Did you get this? Did you get this?
Yeah.
But when you're at home, so presumably, I mean, that home working exacerbates that.
It does. And I think we have to adapt to that and we have to become smarter.
And how would you recommend companies adapt to that?
I think it is about really going back to the basics. We generate massive amounts of information on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis. A lot of it actually has no value at all. If you think about your email or my email, you know, the vast volumes that we see coming through that, only a small percentage has got any real value. And for those who are listening to me, then, you know, I do try to read most emails that I get from members and that kind of thing, and they, of course, have a lot of value. But I mean, from a security perspective, we have to get smarter about understanding where our crown jewels are. What is it that we actually want to protect? How do we air gap our systems? How do we make sure that we are providing all of the resources that are required to manage risk, as far as the business is concerned anyway, and protect the core data? The rest of it you can let go. And that makes life a lot easier. Then you have to make it really simple for the user. So don't confuse the user. You need real clarity around policies and processes. You need to provide training in the moment. You know, these are things that we've talked about in the industry for many, many years. And I think that with the move to hybrid working environments, they're becoming even more important.
Let's pull out now and get a bigger picture, the sort of economic and political waters that we're now swimming in. We're living in an age of great uncertainty, with increasingly unstable geopolitical conditions, which are going to have a long-term impact on markets. How do you see that uncertainty impacting on cyber?
I think uncertainty is, people respond to uncertainty in one of two ways. You either love it or you hate it. Security, as a rule, hates uncertainty because that makes life a little bit more difficult. You know, we like to be able to know what's coming so we can plan for it and we can put security process and policies around it. But uncertainty also breeds innovation because you have to adapt. You have no option but to adapt. You know, you can either park yourself up and wait for the storm to blow over or recognize that you don't know when it's going to blow over, you might as well get on with it.
Yeah, as we all did during the pandemic.
Exactly. And if you think about, you know, the pandemic is a really good example, because if you think about how much innovation came about in a very, very short space of time, we are very
well equipped. Speeded up home working by years, didn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you're never going to go back. Mm. So I do think that uncertainty isn't always a bad thing. It's how you respond to it. And again, this comes down to, I think, you know, a lot of businesses having to really focus back on their core, to really understand what is important to protect from a security standpoint, and to think about the way in which they need to adapt their policies and processes in the age of edge computing, in the age of cloud computing, in the age of widely dispersed workforces and increasingly complex supply chains that are here today and in some cases gone tomorrow.
But if there is a global recession, how worried are you that cyber budgets will slip down the list of priorities?
I'm probably less worried today than I was 2 or 3 years ago. And I say that because I think that there is a better level of understanding now in the boardroom with business executives about the importance of cyber. I've often talked about the fact that there isn't a business out there that doesn't rely on cyber to do what it does. It doesn't matter whether you're delivering milk or running a bank. You're dependent on technology. If you're dependent on technology, you're dependent on cyber, and security has to be a key component in that. So I think that level of awareness has been raised very significantly, and we've got the pandemic to thank for that, I would suggest. So I think that we are going to see tighter scrutiny of budgets. But you would expect that anyway, wouldn't you, in a recession? You know, where can I actually reduce some of my spend? And again, I do hope that what that will do is to really focus the mind on what is absolutely essential for us to protect. So again, if you think to some of the things I've just been saying about volumes of data and how do you protect everything, it could actually be very good for the industry in that it focuses us all down on what we need to do, absolutely, make sure that we're provided with the right level of resourcing to do that. Because it isn't just about money, it's about people as well. And yes, it may make us slightly leaner, but that may not be a bad thing in all instances. So I actually see it, it may sound strange, you know, I see it in quite a positive way. It's just a natural cycle that we're going through. I mean, I forget how many recessions, you know, we've sort of worked through, and this one won't be the last.
Indeed. And you mentioned you feel a little bit more positive because it's reached the boardroom. I mean, how key is that? Because, of course, in the past, we may have had greater understanding further down the organisation, but not necessarily in the boardroom. But have you seen a real shift there?
I have. And I've seen that with our members. I've seen that with some of the work that I do down at Henley Business School with the Board Development Programme there, where the richness of conversation that we have around the role that cyber security has to play in the business has, it bears no resemblance, frankly, to where it was just a couple of 3 years ago. So we're still not where we need to be. You know, we're still on that journey, but we're certainly making the right amount of progress, I think, down that road. And that is hugely important because cyber is becoming more and more complex. And we need to have that level of understanding. We need to have that intelligent conversation. So, you know, other examples of maturity that we're starting to see is in certain parts of the world, boards having to have a director who understands cyber. Are we going to get down to a level of personal liability? Potentially, we're starting to see that in some geographies as well. And again, you know, there was initial resistance to that, but actually, should there be? Because as a director of an organization, you're ultimately responsible anyway. So again, I see that as a maturing and a positive move.
Let's move on to big tech, and more specifically, corporate responsibility in big tech. Big topic right now. With questions being asked about the responsibility big tech owes to consumers and corporations who use their products and services, do you think we're going to start to see public demand for greater accountability and security from tech companies?
I think certainly greater accountability. I think that we've started to see some of that with the European Union in the way that they have moved, particularly against some big tech organisations.
So that'll come with regulation?
I think
it will. It's not going to come from within big tech itself?
I would have said not. And, you know, maybe people will take exception to that, but I can't see it. I think it is going to have to come from the outside. I think as well we're going to see possibly, and I would welcome this, a little bit of fragmentation. I think that we've perhaps centred too much within a small number of technology companies. And I don't think that that's necessarily good for the industry, because I think it does tend to stifle innovation. You know, the norm has always been that if you're a very successful startup in the tech space, your goal is to be bought by somebody in big tech. I don't see that as being necessarily a positive move. I'd like to see us really encouraging much more entrepreneurial spirit and innovation with smaller organizations.
More competition.
Much more competition is, I think, what we actually need.
Yeah.
Lack of this control over what's going on. And I think that can only be good for the markets.
Presumably it's not just that. Legislation, but I mean, the push will come from consumers as well, demanding change in this direction.
I think so. And I think that one of the things that, again, will help drive that is this greater complexity or capability of the technology that you and I are able to use. So it's no longer, you know, having to hand it off to a third party. We can do a lot ourselves. You know, if you're using an iPad, for instance, you could do a lot on an iPad. If you're using a Mac or a PC, you can do a lot on there. And so the big tech is losing some of the grip on that end of it. But of course, you're probably storing it in the cloud. You're probably having to work with some form of other software that is owned by big tech. And so where is the data? Who owns it? And all of those sorts of things. And what are they doing with that information? But in terms of the ability to innovate, the tools are actually now much more in the hands of the user. And so the concern has moved to the back end. And that, again, is where I think we need to bring in a little bit more regulation around what big tech is able to do with that, how they do it, and indeed where.
So, I mean, is the answer much more government oversight or more government oversight?
I think it's sensible government oversight.
And
actually following through where you've got laws, where you've got regulations, enforce them. It's back to what I said originally, you know, give me very solid tram lines and I'll work within them. Don't give me grey, don't give me wobbly lines, because that isn't helping anybody.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kirsty.
Our thanks to this week's guest, Kirsty Lang. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.